Hello, hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another episode of the Daily French Show. I hope that I've noticed that quite a few of the videos, my voice is a bit funny for the first couple of seconds, and hopefully that clears up quite quickly. But anyway, I'm your host, Nicolas Larimer, and today I'm joined for the final episode of the year, or at least the final regular episode. There may, in fact, be a couple of specials coming. In fact, there almost certainly will be tomorrow with our CEO, well, our two CEOs, our one who's going out, Franz Cronier, and our one who's coming in, John Idris, who are going to be on a show that I'm recording later. But anyway, for this last regular episode, I'm joined today by Mr. Herman Pretorius. Herman, how are you?
I'm very well. I feel slightly like a Catholic with the two popes. Just these two CEOs. And the problem is, our critics will think we just send out white smoke just, you know, for the sake of it. Because we're racist. But anyhow, I'm, your voice is funny for the first few seconds of the recording. I'm funny for the first few seconds of the recording, and then that's done. It's gone.
As the kids say, big if true. And of course, Mr. Maurice Ruit, the lion of the East Rand. Maurice,
how's it? Can I just say, Nick, since I met you 2018 or whatever it was, I've thought your voice has always been funny. And Herman, I've never thought you are funny, so... That's a joke. Sometimes your dad jokes, sometimes you make me giggle.
Yeah, no, I thought it might be a joke with you. It's always difficult to tell.
But with Herman, also the fact that you're not a dad means you're a faux pas when you tell a dad joke.
Yeah, well, that's apparent.
Anyway, so as you can tell, today's not going to be a particularly structured episode because we really can't be bothered to be all too formal on this last day of the year. I think let's just have some fun.
Which is obviously very different from the rest of the year.
Yeah. We're normally the epitome of professionalism and focus. You know, we always just get straight to the point. Speaking of not getting straight to the point, I just see on Reuters now that China, we talked about on the show a while ago, has been criticizing a democracy summit that Taiwan was invited to. And Taiwan simply said, get democratic yourself. And then they didn't say this, but they implied losers. So anyway, I'm very glad that Taiwan is giving China
I saw a brilliant map the other day on some Facebook page of terrible maps. Is you've got the Taiwan and then the whole of China, just Western Taiwan. And I just thought, my goodness, is that terrible?
What a beautiful dream.
My favorite map from Terrible Maps is when the color is, say, blue, and says countries that have lost a war to Vietnamese peasants. And the only country with that color is the United States.
No, man, it's not fair because China also lost the war to them.
Yes, that's true. And Cambodia also lost Cambodia to Vietnamese peasants.
Yes.
But I mean, if Vietnamese peasants fight the Cambodian peasants, not exactly. Yeah, it's not a clash of the superpowers.
Anyway. Also, you know, I have a lot of axes to grind in the traditional narratives of the Vietnam War.
That's why I brought it up. I knew it gets under your skin.
Yeah, I know. You're threatening to send me down a tangent that has absolutely nothing to do with what we wanted to talk about today. So let's finally get to it after, you know, 4 minutes of waffle. And that is, Herman, I could feel some sort of dad joke energy there. And I really hope. Okay, no. Okay, good. right. So we've had an interesting and eventful year. I think there's a lot to think about this year. I think it might be one of those turning points, at least in South Africa, and maybe the world, to be honest, because you know, it feels like a lot is on the move in the world at the moment. Maybe that's just me. Maybe that's just because I've been paying close attention to the news over the last year. But I feel like this has been a pretty important year, in a way that, say, 2019 or 2018 weren't. So let me start with you, Marius. What do you think is the biggest thing that's happened this year? And who do you think are some of the big personalities of this year? And you can talk about South Africa, you can talk about the world, whatever's on your mind.
Yeah, these kind of things are always hard to, because the things that have happened closer to today is obviously what's going to be on your mind. So one of the big things for me, and I've spoken about this, is obviously the election we had last month. And, you know, the fact that the ANC went under 50%, I think I think maybe it's what the Americans talk about when they talk about realigning elections. And I think that could maybe be that for South Africa. I mean, the first time ever since the ANC could participate in elections in a nationwide election as fewer than 50% of the voters voted for them. And for me, that's pretty big. We've also been talking about it internally, just, you know, who's the Euro of the year and who's the Mampara of the year. I think maybe the Euro of the year would be the South African voter, because they actually came out and voted for, more than 50% of the voters didn't vote for the ANC. But then at the same time, only 30% of South Africans are South African voters. The rest, everybody else decided to, you know, kind of stay at home and, you know, enjoy the day off, or they just weren't very taken by the choices.
And to be fair, the South African voters, rather than coalescing behind some sort of coherent challenge to the ANC, split their vote among a million tiny billion parties, that a lot of whom are like kind of three dudes and a dog kind of parties.
Exactly. But I think also, just globally speaking, I do think we are living through one of those history periods which will be covered in a history book as events that led to this war and what have you. You know, as and we see the various arrows on the map and the kind of alliances starting to coalesce.
The 1930s feeling of this decade is quite
spectacular. I feel like like 1936, or when was the Sudetenland invaded? It was 38 or 39 or
38, I think.
Yeah. So it does kind of feel like, and there's definitely saber rattling from the Chinese over Taiwan, and actually also Asia in general. I've also seen, I mean, India and China have even started to go to blows, and that's pretty scary. I mean, they're both nuclear powers, and they're both it's the most populated country on Earth and the second most populated country on Earth. And like I say, both nuclear powers, both with very big armies and so on. But also, I mean, what you've seen is happening in the Ukraine with Russia and Vladimir Putin. I think that's also something to watch. But I think overall, I mean, this also could be one of those things where you only think it because you are living through the moments, but it does feel like 2021 is going to be one of those kind of hinge years in world history where a lot of stuff is happening, or a lot of stuff that what's happening in 2020 is going to lead to a lot of very important stuff happening in the next 10 or 20 years. But also that maybe you only have that feeling because you're living through it. I mean, everybody probably thinks that they're living through the most important time in human history. But it does feel that 2021 is quite an important time. Yeah, there's a lot of stuff happening, a lot of moving parts.
I think with only a couple of years of hindsight, we can say that, you know, 2017, 2018, 2019 were not anything like the same kind of hinge years that this one has been.
I mean, so, you see, 2016 was a hinge year. So we had Brexit, we had Trump winning the election there, and that's led to all kinds of other things.
I have a pet theory that 2012 was actually more important than 2016.
I agree.
But that's far too complicated a discussion for today. Herman, for 10 points, something really important in South Africa this year that isn't the elections.
It's difficult to pick one thing, because I can't pick the elections, then one can sort of pick the ANC's response to the elections, which has been nothing. Cyril Ramaphosa barely acknowledged that these elections took place. To me, it's very interesting that the ANC is very much like a racist deer in headlights, in the sense that it really doesn't know where to go from here. So that's very interesting. But I must say, if we look locally, I think the election, of course, the July riots, we might have forgotten about the fact that, you know, Zuma was arrested, spent time in prison. But what I'm really, the thing from 2021, I think, that stands out to me, that is sort of course setting for what's to come, is the global issue of inflation.
Yeah, I think that's a good one. So I want to firstly say that you kind of stole my one there, which was, I think the July riots for me were the really big issue of the year. Actually, I think that a lot of the things that have happened in South Africa since have been a sort of a direct or indirect result of that. I think the election results can partially be explained by the July riots. But for me, what they really showed was that the sort of myth of the ANC's authority, power, and invincibility kind of began to really collapse in the July riots. And ordinary South Africans realized for the first time that they actually have a lot of power to affect things.
And I, oftentimes I think we've all heard this is South Africa is going the Zimbabwe route and stuff like that, and in many instances there are you know certainly parallels, but one of the interesting things that certainly distinguishes the Zimbabwe trajectory from the South African trajectory or possible trajectory is Mugabe had the insight and the wisdom to sort of keep his army and his armed forces and you know pseudo military entities like the police de facto in Zimbabwe in line and bit you know broadly competent, staffed, equipped, trained, and politically happy. And we in South Africa can be very, very lucky that the South African... up to a point.
They did overthrow him.
Yes, they did. But I think what distinguishes South Africa from Zimbabwe is our military and our police state is where the violent elements of the state are spectacularly useless and politically irrelevant in the sense that the July riots... I mean, the COVID preceding year of 2020 and so on, but the July riots really illustrated how useless the military or violent or you know legitimate violent forces arms of the government is, and that is an important thing to realize for South Africans, both defensively in the sense that you can't rely on them to defend you, but also proactively is you can't necessarily you don't have to be scared of them stopping you from doing what you think needs to be done.
Yeah, I have a Zimbabwean friend who's very much not a liberal. And even though she's no fan of ZANU-PF, she certainly has at least a sort of grudging respect for the Zimbabwean police because in the way she describes it, they sort of seem to solve everything with shambox. And I think that's very different from our police, who sometimes use to solve things with shambox, but most of the time they just don't pitch.
Or get robbed.
One other difference, I think, between South Africa and Zimbabwe is the level of internal democracy between ZANU-PF and the ANC. And I know in the ANC, there's a lot of vote buying and so on, but it does seem that there is quite robust internal democracy within the ANC, and people can criticize, you know, the president or the top six. And I don't think that was ever the case with ZANU-PF. I think, you know, Robert Mugabe, you know, he ruled that party with the iron fist. And, you know, I think the closest parallel in South Africa is probably the EFF. There's much internal democracy within the EFF.
Until they overthrew him in a coup. So, I mean...
Yeah, exactly. But it did
once
take
again, up to a point.
Robert Mugabe was in charge of ZANU-PF for, 40 years? You know, so it took a while for them to... You know, and there was never any real threat to his rule. Also, mainly because he killed anybody who was likely to become an actual threat to him. So I think there's... And, oh, sorry, just one last thing. Obviously, comparatively speaking, Zimbabwe is much more ethnically homogenous than South Africa. About 80% of the population is Shona compared to South Africa. Where I think Zulus are the single biggest ethnic group and they only make about 20% of the population.
I think it's very easy to canonize Mandela politically and just see him as the saint of brilliance. And there's no getting around the fact that he was good in some areas and quite awful in other areas, especially if we think that he... I think he dropped the ball on AIDS very early on. I think a lot of the ESCOM problems we're facing really dates back to that very first ANC term in office. But if there's one thing, Armsteel, absolutely. And I think Serafina, yes, of course. But the one thing that I will always appreciate Mandela for, no matter what criticism goes against him and what errors he made, is his voluntary distancing or stepping back from power. In after one term, and I think that is often underappreciated as a pivotal moment for South Africa and the hope we have. It showed the markets and the world that this wasn't just you know a new personality cult in the mold of Mugabe, and it also created ANC factionalism that weakened this behemothic thing for internal competition.
No, I think that's a very good point. And I've been thinking recently about a comparison between why a country like Gran Colombia didn't work and a country like the United States did work. And there's a lot of reason for it. But one of the reasons is because the first president of the United States, George Washington, stepped down after two terms. And the first president of Gran Colombia, who was an admirer of George Washington and very much wanted to copy the United States, stayed in office basically until he could no longer. I think he either died in office or he was chucked out Simon Boulevard.
Yeah, so
and that set a precedent.
Yeah, and interestingly, to bring it back to the present day, that's really the next big question in South Africa is how does the leader of the ANC, whether it's Ramaphosa after 2022 or someone else, how do they respond to a democratic and electoral defeat in 2024? And it's a very, if you look at how the ANC is responding so far, it's very much, you know, all over the place. In some instances, you've got the madness of Itakwini, where they literally storm the building, try to just disrupt. But then there are other instances where there's a voluntary and somewhat dignified handover of power. And say what you want of Masina. He did step away from his office. I think he's an absolute idiot, but he stepped away voluntarily with some grace. So that's really the next big question for the ANC is, do they still have some connection to the idea of civility? Because if someone like Masina can, there's some hope. But really, it's a tough one to call.
Justin, one thing you mentioned, I said, if Ramaphosa is still president of the ANC, if he doesn't get recalled in 2022, I just want to say, if the ANC recalls Cyril Ramaphosa, then they are committing suicide. They'll put a bullet through their brain. The ANC will get, if they put whoever, Dave Mabuza, Ace Magashule, whatever, you know, even Paul Mashatile, somebody who's half decent. They'll be a 35 or 40% party in 2024, and that'll be the end of them. And once the ANC loses power, that is the end of the ANC. Just once the National Party lost power in this country, UNIP in Zambia, KANU in Kenya, I mean, lots of
the ANC in the Western Cape.
Exactly. So
once they lose power, thing I just want to say is don't underestimate Nick drew this parallel at one stage is and in the very last years of the Roman Empire before its total collapse, at least I think the Eastern Empire's collapse. The Western Empire. Empire's collapse. These various factions were willing to literally aid barbarians and vandals, destroying cities and, you know, tactically seeing defeats that would weaken their factional opponents to such a point that the whole thing collapsed. So don't think that the ANC's ability to see Ramaphosa as an electoral asset, which he undoubtedly is, the data shows that quite clearly, despite what happened in the last 2 years, in September of this year, Ramaphosa had an approval rating of all South Africans above 60%. Don't underestimate the ability of ANC factionalism to really just collapse the empire.
Yes, no, since it's my point, I agree with it very strongly. But so speaking of Ramaphosa, you know, we've been kind of discussing, as we said, who the sort of heroes are and who the villains are of the year. And I really think that Ramaphosa has demonstrated this year that he was a terrible president. So I saw News24, which I criticized in the past as being very close to him, gave him a 5 out of 10. And you might think, oh, well, they're not that close to them if they're giving him a 5 out of 10. I think 5 out of 10 is extraordinarily generous.
Yes.
So number one, the drive towards expropriation without compensation, which we're going to see at least possibly a conclusion to on the 7th of December, although that may be postponed. We're not quite sure yet. That's, you know, a pretty bad mark on his presidency. But beyond that, just think about his presidential leadership. Where was he after the July riots? He was kind of didn't go to KZN. He was, I think, overseas for some of it. He was very much in the background, and he's been that way for the vast majority of his presidency. He's just never, ever actually showed up at a time when it's difficult to do something. He doesn't give interviews unless it's to very friendly sources. He's just absent unless he's there for a smiling photo op with people while jogging in Cape Town.
And you know what? Well, you know what's made me realize that he's probably not a very good person. So after Collins Khoza was murdered, let's call it what it was, he was murdered. President Ramaphosa said, yes, some of our security forces were a bit over-enthusiastic. He didn't say this is terrible, it's a disgusting blot on South Africa. You know, an innocent man was beaten to death by the security forces and go to see this poor man's wife and his family. And so I'm so sorry, I apologize for everything, what happened. You were just like, oh, sorry, our security force is a bit over-enthusiastic. No apology, nothing. And just, you know, it's really, and yeah, it's still, it really, it's one of the things that's made me most sick about South Africa in the last few years is the death of Collins Khoza, and, you know, a lot of other people, Pietrus Michels, you know, people who get killed by the cops, Nathaniel Julies, whatever.
No.
He just doesn't care, you know, and I think also, like Nick says, he doesn't take interviews, you know, he doesn't consider South Africans as citizens. He considers, and this is the ANC actually, considers South Africans as subjects.
Yeah. And I think on 2 points, I think Ramaphosa did one good thing this year, and this was his, and if that's as good as it gets, it's really quite terrible. And that was his response to the world freaking out about the Omicron variant. His criticism of the international reaction to that, I think, was the first useful thing he has ever done. I don't know if he has really achieved anything there, but I think he was right in that. And he showed some leadership, and I think he actually legitimately applied some international pressure we saw Nigeria joining in. So, you know, there's actually some movement. There's actually some leadership. But for the rest, I mean, if we're going to say he has to do 10 good things in a year to get a score out of 10, then at the best, I think he's a one. He's a one out of 10 because the rest was just, you know, spectacularly awful. And to add on that point about Collins Khoza, I wonder, if I were a member of parliament, I would ask every minister I could in a parliamentary question, do you know who Andres Tatane is? Because I'm sure they've forgotten. Because he was really the first case of a black life not mattering to this government. A politician, a peaceful guy by all accounts, not some problematic anger stoker, fear mongerer. No, he was a coke guy.
Even if he was,
you don't kill him.
Exactly.
And yet he was
shot at point blank range with the rubber bullet.
And bled to death on national TV. And I mean, America remember Rosa Parks, who refused to give up a seat in a bus and saw that as a pivotal moment. The fact that the name Andries Tatane these days is barely a footnote in political history, recent history in South Africa, really just shows you the depth to which we've plummeted in terms of value of life and politicians on that.
Exactly.
So on that gloomy note, I think let's just kind of go over a couple of sort of stories that are floating about the news today, and you guys can talk about whichever one you want. So I'm going to bring up two to begin with. The first one being that the government got the fuel price wrong. It announced on Wednesday that actually the fuel price increase that it had announced was too high by 6 cents, and that it had made a mistake in its calculation. And then it revised it down. But then when you actually look at the documents, even its revision might have been a mistake. That's amusing.
It's like an M. Night Shyamalan movie. Just, you know, the 6 cents, I see stupid people. And the fascinating thing here is, that's a big thing. It's really a big thing. To announce the energy price is like one of the big overplayed, you know, powers of the South African government, but it's really big. It informs everything from inflation to, you know, investment confidence. And to get that wrong, and how many people must have gotten that wrong? Did some bloody intern just tweet it out? And then you have to ask the question. I can't remember which DA MP it was that said, yeah, somewhere someone made money about this. So somewhere someone cashed in.
Morris, anything to add to that rant there? I mean, it's just
I've seen a thing going around that at the beginning of the year the petrol price was about $14.50 for a litre. Now it's over $20 bucks. And I mean 30 or 40% of what you pay goes to the government. The government could tomorrow basically halve the petrol price or reduce about 30% by saying, look, we're gonna take, instead of taking $10 every time you fill up $10 for every litre, you're gonna take $5. There you go. That's our Christmas present to you guys. But they won't, because they're running out of money, and yeah, the government. And it's also quite funny, there's also something that goes around on social media and now and then. That's in 1993 when the ANC was basically a normal opposition party. And they're like, you know, this National Party government is anti-poor. They haven't consulted anybody for raising the petrol price, blah, 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 blah.
I remember the ANC in the 90s campaigning on abolishing VAT.
Exactly.
Which they not only kept in place at the same level for what, basically 25 Amazing. Years, and then they then increased it.
Yes.
And it's the most aggressive tax you get.
Because
it affects poor people the most.
But the real sad thing is that I am someone open to listening to arguments for an increased VAT, but then it has to go with the reduction in income tax. I'm completely open to the argument that you're going to tax sales activity rather than income generation, because that's just a more stable and a healthier basis of tax, because then you don't disincentivize wealth creation. And that's sort of what Thatcher and Jeffrey Howe did in their first budget, is they jacked up that significantly. But then over the course of that first term, they adjusted it to lower income tax. So I'm open to that idea. But the thing with the ANC is, and Zweli Mkhize once admitted this to colleagues at the Institute, is it's for them, it's really just about sustainable wealth extraction. And the problem is that we really have now reached that point. Another thing that we didn't talk about this year was, of course, Eskom. But I mean, the collapse of Eskom is just such a run-of-the-mill thing. Oh, and we haven't talked about the glorious reflighting of SAA, which I don't know what's going on there. I doubt I'm in a far more informed position than Praveen Gordhan. But it's just the ANC is really just paralyzed. It has no clue. It has no idea. It can see its support eroding, but it's got no idea where to turn.
ANC does feel like this kind of a punch-drunk boxer, you know, like this heavyweight. Like, it was Muhammad Ali back in the day, you know, took on all comers, nobody stood a chance. But now it's still Muhammad Ali, but it's got, you know, it's brain damage from all the boxing was in and doesn't really know what's going on anymore. And that's because let's not forget, the ANC is still the biggest party in the country.
Yes, but by a significant margin.
It's still more than double the size of the DA. But it's much smaller than it was, and it's definitely wounded. You know, it's taken maybe not a mortal shot, but definitely, you know, if we're thinking to mix the metaphors, if it was a battleship, it's been beneath the bows. Definitely got direct hits, but maybe it's beneath the bows. Is it going to take on water and not survive? We're going to have to see.
But one thing that was really fascinating, and sorry, Nick, is also that we can list the disasters of the ANC, and they are like fundamental, life-destroying, country-destroying disasters. We should just recap the other disasters for the main opposition party. They put up a poster. They took it down. The leader smiled in a podcast.
Smirked
in a podcast. Yeah. I mean, it's just, yeah, well, potato paresist.
So I'd like to end...
Can I just say two more things then?
Yeah.
I just like to say that we talked about earlier, which I think is very interesting. Modemole Mokopong municipality was decided by coin toss today. And that the...
Because they tied five votes, I believe.
Yeah, or 7-7, I think it would have worked out as. But and that the Indian Cricket Tour is still at the moment on for the end of the year, but it's looking a bit iffy with Omicron. And if it doesn't go ahead, Cricket South Africa is going to be in huge shit financially. I mean, huge trouble, sorry. Shouldn't have sworn on the podcast, but yeah. Huge trouble.
Yeah, well, that's the thing about things in India. We often hope they just carry on.
Oh, my God. Anyway, okay. So I'd like to end with a little segment I like to call It Could Be Worse. Two top Lesotho government officials are currently facing treason and murder charges over the failed 2014 coup. Lesotho's development planning minister and former deputy prime minister are currently about to face treason and murder charges, along with a number of army officers, for attempting to remove former prime minister Thomas Thabane in a coup attempt in 2014. Thomas Thabane is now also currently, I believe, being charged with murdering his ex-wife or his estranged wife. And the members of the Lesotho government who are now going on trial say that if SADC, that is the South African Development Community, doesn't intervene to prevent their politicized appearance in court, that they will have to withdraw from the reconciliation process or something to that effect. There's a sort of implied threat that, you know, the country is not going to be very governable if they go to court. Yeah.
Well, one aspires to a country where the politicians kill each other rather than the people.
Well, they already do that here.
Yeah, exactly.
Why not both?
Anyway, thank you, everyone, for joining us for this year. It's been an eventful year. We've grown a lot as a show, and that's thanks to you guys. So thank you so much for your support. Thank you for your listening. And hopefully, yeah, join us again on the 12th of January for our regular episodes next year. But do look out. Tomorrow there will be a special with Franz Cronier and John Endres. That is the outgoing CEO of the IRR and the incoming CEO of the IRR, who are just going to be talking probably about the same sort of stuff we talked about today. And I think that'll be really good. So, yeah, tune in for that. And, yeah, we'll see you next year for our most fantastic and awesome year, I'm sure. Or at least an eventful one. But eventful in a good sense, not a bad sense, I hope. Anyway, we'll see. Thanks, everyone, and have a wonderful December holidays. Cheers.